Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN here in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, 7th of October. And as we all know, this day marks the 2 years from the horrific attack against Israelis in by the Hamas and other Palestinian armed groups. I will start by reading the statement of the Secretary General, and then we'll give the floor to my colleagues who will also read statements on behalf of their organization. So says the Secretary General's message. 2 years ago today, Hamas and other Palestinian armed groups launched an abhorrent large-scale terror attack on Israel. The attackers brutally killed more than 1,250 Israelis and foreign nationals. More than 250 others were abducted and taken into the Gaza Strip as hostages, including women, children, and the elderly. On this day, let us remember all those who were killed and suffered horrific violence. The horror of that dark day will be forever seared in the memories of us all. 2 years later, hostages remain captive in Gaza in deplorable conditions. I have met, says the Secretary General, with hostages' families and survivors who shared their unbearable pain. The Secretary General continues by saying, I have said it time and again, and I'm repeating it today with even greater urgency. Release the hostages unconditionally and immediately, and the suffering for all. This is a humanitarian catastrophe on a scale that defies comprehension. Put an end to the hostility in Gaza, Israel, and the region now. Stop making civilians pay with their lives and their future. After 2 years of trauma, we must choose hope now, says the Secretary General. The recent proposal by US President Donald J. Trump presents an opportunity that must be seized to bring this tragic conflict to an end. A permanent ceasefire and a credible political process are essential to prevent further bloodshed and pave the way for peace. International law must be respected. The United Nations remains unwavering in its commitment to support peace. And the Secretary General, to conclude, on this solemn anniversary, let us honor the memory of all the victims by working for the only path forward, a just and lasting peace in which Israelis, Palestinians, and all the peoples of the region live side by side in security, dignity, and mutual respect. That is dated of today from the Secretary General. I give the floor now to Jens for the statement from Tom Fletcher.
Yes. Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. So we have shared this statement with you earlier, but I want to read it into the record as well and give a couple of additional points. So this is a statement by Tom Fletcher, the Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator. And he says as follows, 2 years on since Hamas and other armed groups carried out those abhorrent attacks in Israel, the pain is indescribable. Today, I renew my call for the unconditional, immediate release of all the hostages, and until then, they must be treated humanely. Civilians everywhere have to be protected. Tens of thousands of Palestinians have been killed. Hundreds of thousands endure starvation and displacement. So we renew the call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, for all civilians to be protected, and for humanitarian aid to flow freely at the scale needed. There's now a glimmer of hope that this can happen. We must keep it alive. A couple of additional numbers I want to put in there. We heard from the Secretary General's statement about fatalities and particularly people captured, hostages taken. And the information that we have, and that is sourced to Israeli media, which are citing official sources, is that as of 1st of October, 48 hostages remain, and that includes people known or assessed to be killed. When Mr. Fletcher speaks about Palestinians who have been killed in Gaza, the numbers that we have, and that is from the Ministry of Health in Gaza, is 66,288, of whom 18,430 are children. When Mr. Fletcher speaks about hunger and starvation, the number that we have from WHO, verified by WHO, is that 400 people, Palestinians, have died of malnutrition. When Mr. Fletcher speaks about humanitarian aid must flow freely and at the scale needed, over these 2 years, we have had more than 8,000 coordinated mission and movement requests, of which more than a quarter have been denied. These coordinated missions, out of the more than 8,000, 45% have been denied or impeded. Impeded means that they have been allowed to start, but they have been impeded en route and have either been held up, delayed, or even forced to return. 10% of the requests that we have put in have been withdrawn. That is typically because situation changed between the request is submitted and the reply comes back. And 45%, so less than half, have been facilitated by Israeli authorities and reached their intended target. I just wanted to give you those additional numbers, and they cover the two-year period, the full two-year period. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jens. Ricardo, on behalf of UNICEF.
Good morning. Bonjour à tous. Of course, today on October 7th, we remember all those who were brutally killed and suffered unspeakable violence when Hamas launched a large-scale attack in Israel, killing over 1,250 Israelis and foreign nationals, including children and women. More than 250 people were abducted and taken to Gaza, including many women and children. Some hostages remain in Gaza, and we, of course, call for them to be released safely so they can return to their families, and we condemn any acts of violence, such as the ones that happened 2 years ago in Israel. But today is also the day that we ask Israel to stop the indiscriminate killing of children across the Gaza Strip. For nearly 2 years now, children have paid the heaviest price in this crisis. 61,000 children have reportedly been either killed or maimed since the horrors Hamas unleashed in Israel and what followed after the disproportionate response from Israel that is still ongoing. That's an average of one child either killed or maimed every 17 minutes. This is an unacceptable, staggering figure that we still have to live with today. Children have been suffering in their bodies and their minds for way too long. They've been traumatized, exposed to horrors that no child should ever have to look at or live. They've been orphaned, they've lost their homes, they've been displaced multiple times, they've been exposed to disease and violence in a scale that is unprecedented for Gaza. So today we call on Israel to stop that violence. We call for a ceasefire. We welcome the plans by the US government, which bring a glimpse of hope to the region and to civilians and children in Gaza, that a better future is ahead. But what we're hearing from colleagues on the ground, and I heard from colleagues today, that the violence continues in the north part of Gaza and in the south, bombardments, airstrikes, children dying. We've been denied to bring incubators and ventilators to children from the north. They're desperately needing that to survive. We're talking about children sharing oxygen masks in order to stay alive. And those requests have been declined day in and day out. And we're still waiting today, hopefully, for that to happen. So again, the horrors of October 7 can never be forgotten. And we condemn and will always condemn violence against children, women, and civilians at such a scale. But the disproportionate response that followed and today continues needs to end, and it needs to end now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ricardo. And I would like now to read you a statement on behalf of UNRWA. I've been asked to read to you. The message has already been published. You have it on the X account of Philippe Lazzarini, the Commissioner General. Grief, suffering, deep and immense pain, the reality for far too many people since 7 October 2023. And in Gaza, for 2 long years, people have known nothing but destruction, displacement, bombardment, fear, death, and hunger. As we mark 2 years of the beginning of this nightmare, I call once again for the release of all hostages and Palestinian detainees, an immediate ceasefire, the guns must go silent everywhere, the unfettered delivery of basic humanitarian supplies at scale to Gaza, including through UNRWA, accountability and justice to hold all those accountable for atrocities committed on and after 7 October. There is no other way out of this abyss and mayhem, says the Commissioner General of UNRWA. Ceasefire now. Thank you. So I think we have now heard from the various colleagues who had statement for these days. I'd like to open the floor to questions, if any. Don't see any. Yes, Emma.
Good morning. Just a quick clarification from Jens, please. Those 8,000 missions, were they within Gaza? Just wanted to clarify that. And Ricardo, you mentioned the children sharing oxygen masks in the north and that there should be a development today. Can you just tell us more about that? And also the babies that we discussed. Is there any update on the babies in incubators in Gaza City? Thank you.
Yes, they are missions inside Gaza where we need coordination with the Israeli authorities, right? There are other movements where we don't need that, but this is where we need approval from the Israeli authorities, and the logic of that is that those are to the worst affected places, right? That's where the war is going on. That's where we need coordination.
Yeah, on the babies, Emma, as you know, we had over 20 babies in the north in incubators because they were born prematurely, which is happening a lot in Gaza now. One in every five child with who's born in Gaza is born premature without the infrastructure to receive them and keep them safe and alive. We've managed to move them to another facility when the hospital they were on needed to be evacuated, but we haven't managed to move the incubators so they can, again, be placed in those incubators to stay warm and with enough oxygen to stay alive. And those incubators and those ventilators are the ones we're trying to move, and it's been denied so far. We're hoping that by the end of the week, we will be able to move that, but I've been hearing from colleagues on the ground for the last 3-4 days that's just not happening.
And where are they now, and how long then have these premature babies been without incubators?
I'm not 100% sure on that, but I can get back to you. But they haven't been moved farther to the south, as I understand. So they're still pretty much at risk in a combat zone.
Thank you very much. Not Mohammed.
Thank you, Alessandra. My question is for Jens, also for you. It's about President Trump's Gaza plan. As you remember, we talked about it last week here. And Jens, you said the United Nations is not part of that plan. My question is the United Nations is still not part of that plan? And what can you say more about that plan?
Thank you, Mohammed. I think I said that the UN was not part of drafting the plan. We are part of the plan because we're mentioned in it. But we were not part of writing it up, right? We have, as we've always said, and that we have demonstrated in the last ceasefire, our own plan, which is logistics mostly, right? But it requires a number of things, particularly from the Israeli side, before it can happen. And we have briefed about those very often, opening all access routes, direct access to the north, stop banning stuff that shouldn't be banned because it's life-saving aid, and those sort of things. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry, thank you very much. I saw Jeremy, and then Isabel.
It was just a quick follow-up on Emma's question about the babies. You're saying that you have difficulties to move the incubators. So the question is, how long can those babies survive without the incubators? Can they actually wait for the end of the week?
That's a very good question. I'm not a doctor, so I can't give you specifically the number of days that a baby would survive. But as I understand, they've been moved temporarily to an area where they can still access the healthcare that they need to survive, including ventilators. The issue is that there's just not enough for all the babies that are needing that. So they're having to share that infrastructure, which obviously is not sustainable. So we're trying to urgently move the incubators from the north so they can each be in one of those incubators and not have to share, as I've seen in Gaza, four babies sharing an incubator just because, you know, we've been denied importing more.
Isabel?
Good morning. This is for Jens. I read in the daily news update that we received this morning that there is apparently some improvements. The update talks about 8 missions that were facilitated in the last few days by Israel, WFP being able to deliver with flour to bakeries, and also a total of almost 900,000 meals delivered also through kitchens across Gaza. So do you see this as a sign of some improvement, given the fact that there are negotiations in place, or these are really insignificant or insufficient things that are happening in Gaza?
If you look at the baseline of the situation in Gaza, then any aid that gets in, right now particularly food, is positive and is a good development. So these things have fluctuated over time, sometimes more, sometimes less, and it's quite, of course, unpredictable, which is not great for humanitarians because we like to plan ahead. We have pipelines to fill. So, of course, it is that's a positive development. But that is all we can say about it. It's not necessarily an indication of anything major happening. We hope it is, but only time will tell.
Thank you very much. I'll go to the platform. Imen.
Thank you so much. I have two questions, actually, for UNICEF. Do you have the total number of children that have been killed in Palestine since October 2023? And the second question, the Palestinian authorities speaks about more than 11,000 Palestinian hostages in the Israeli jails, including more than 400 children. Do you have any update or any information? And do you have any contact of them and their families? Thank you. That's for Ricardo. Thank you.
So on the number of children reportedly killed, we follow the figures from the Ministry of Health. And as it stands, we are over 20,000 children reportedly killed since October 7th. That's in Gaza. I don't have the figures in front of me for the West Bank, but we know that the numbers are also very high, even compared to previous escalations. Your second question on Palestinian children detained, I would have to get back to you on that. I don't have any information right now on what UNICEF is actively doing, but obviously we call for their protection and for them to be treated fairly as any civilian should, and not in any inhumane manner.
Yes, you have more figures.
Yeah, and I, apologies. I just wanted to add what you mentioned there, because I do have numbers for the West Bank that we collect. So Palestinians killed by Israeli forces or settlers since the 7th of October 2023 in the West Bank is 998, of which children are 212.
Thank you. John?
Yes, good morning. Question to both Jens and Ricardo. Firstly, Ricardo or Jens, what's the official explanation from the Israeli authorities to your request to move the incubators? What's the official explanation why you're being denied the movement? And secondly, Jens, you mentioned 400 verified WHO that have died of malnutrition. Do we know how many of these were children? And secondly, how many people suffering from malnutrition, severe acute malnutrition, are right now fighting for their lives? Thank you.
The incubators are in the north of Gaza. So what we are hearing from colleagues on the ground is that the green light to move our convoys to pick up those incubators are not being given because of safety and military operations happening on the ground.
Yeah, thank you, John. Of the 400 I mentioned, 101 is children, if I can put it like that. So a quarter of them are children. And what was the second part of your question?
I don't remember. Sorry. John? He's not, we can't hear him. Oh, okay. He's back.
Yeah, my second part of the question, Jens, was what percentage, how many people are suffering from severe acute malnutrition and fighting for their life? We had 400 that have died, but how many are in a critical condition and potentially could die right now, especially children under the age of 5? And
Jens, I'll give you the floor. Christian, you are on the line in case you wanted to add something. Jens.
Yeah, thank you, John. I think that one is for WHO. I don't have more granular figures or information on that particular issue.
So I'll let Christian think if he can give you some kind of answer. I see you are on. Christian, go ahead.
Yeah, I would need to hear the question again, please. Sorry, third time now.
How many people are actually in severe malnutrition and fighting for their lives?
Give me a moment, I'll come back.
Okay, maybe in the meantime we hear from Nick, who has also requested the floor.
Yeah, thank you. Just a very quick question to Jens. Of the 400 Palestinians who you say had died of malnutrition, that's in what period of time? When did that start to occur? Thank you.
That is from the 7th October 2023, but there has clearly been it's not an equal distribution, as you know, because food insecurity has skyrocketed to a point where parts of Gaza is in a declared famine.
Christian.
Yeah, let me try. So over 500,000 people trapped in the famine in Gaza, as per the latest IPC analysis of August. With 640,000 people facing catastrophic levels of food insecurity. That's the IPC phase 5. 400 malnutrition-related deaths, including 101 children. I think we heard that figure now, of which 80 of them were under 5 years old, reported by the Ministry of Health since January 2025. 1,050 children were admitted or were under treatment supported at WHO-supported stabilization centers since March 2024. And of those 1,050, roughly half of it, 594, were admitted in 2025.
Ricardo.
Just to add, it's very difficult right now to keep track of the number of children, especially suffering from severe acute malnutrition or acute malnutrition, just because even with the latest IPC, getting the data that we need to make those assessments is extremely challenging given the escalations on the ground, the unpredictability of movement for our teams, for humanitarian workers. So I think the numbers that have been mentioned are the latest, but we know that most indicators are worsening, and famine that was concentrated in Gaza City and was declared in Gaza City is slowly moving to the south as more people get displaced, leaving what it's now, again, a combat zone.
Two follow-ups, John?
Let me jump in quickly there, sorry.
Go ahead.
If I can. Yeah, just exactly to that point just raised, don't forget, the official figures always come either from hospitals, from clinics, or from the stabilization centers. And with those, exactly as just mentioned, many people on the move in cramped conditions or somewhere in shelters, not even able to reach any health center or no ambulance being able to reach them. The estimates must be much higher. Again, the official figures, the official counts are a gross underestimate.
Thank you. John, your follow-up.
Yes. Both to Christian and to Ricardo. Do we know how many therapeutic treatment centers are operating at the moment in Gaza? And what was the number? Has it gone down in the last 6 months? And also your partners, international NGOs, have they got any facilities running, or they've had to shut down or had damage because of the hostilities? Thanks.
So what I have right now are the figures of the official hospitals. So 14 out of the 36 hospitals are partially functioning, and that's zero in north of Gaza, 8 in Gaza City still, 3 in Deir al-Balah and 3 in Khan Yunus. The famous Al-Shifa hospital is minimally function, and mainly also because most of the doctors have now, the specialist doctors have left due to fear for their lives. And only an estimated 40 patients remain, along with a small number of healthcare workers. 10 out of 16 field hospitals are still partially functioning, none of them fully functioning. And equally, 62 out of 176 primary healthcare centers, so roughly a third, are also partially functioning.
Ricardo.
We know that amongst those, some provide therapeutic treatment for children, but way below the scale that is needed right now. And not only in terms of facilities and health services, which the whole system is at the brink of collapse, but also the quantity of ready-to-use therapeutic feeding that needs to get to those children. Even though UNICEF is managing to move some, it's just very, very far from being enough, and children are still suffering, and their conditions are worsening, and the desperation just increasing.
Nick, you also have a follow-up, and then I'll go to Musa.
I was a little unclear from Christian's numbers. I heard you say since January 2025. I wasn't sure to what how many of the numbers you were giving were since January 2025. I wonder if you could clarify that. And in the process, of the 400 who have died of malnutrition, can we say how many have died in the course of this year? Thank you.
The 400 malnutrition-related deaths, including the 101 children, are all since January 2025.
Okay. Thank you. Musa has been waiting patiently. I give you the floor in a second, Jamie. Musa. You have to unmute yourself.
Yeah. Ça va comme ça, c'est bon?
Oui, c'est bon. Dites-nous.
Oui. Alors, je reviens à la déclaration du secrétaire général et le paragraphe qui dit « Le plan de Donald Trump présente une opportunité à saisir pour mettre fin à ce conflit ». Et là, j'ai une question ou bien un éclaircissement sur ces paroles. Bien sûr, il y a le plan de Trump est composé de deux parties. La première, c'est cesser le feu et faire entrer les aides humanitaires, et ça, c'est très, très bien. Mais la deuxième partie, le plan de Trump ne parle pas d'une opportunité pour le futur de Gaza qui sera dirigé par un mélange international, arabe, mais pas les Palestiniens. Et ça, c'est au contraire de résolutions des Nations Unies et de droit international, surtout le droit d'autodétermination. Alors, j'aimerais bien éclaircir un petit peu cette position, parce que là, on voit deux choses différentes. Merci.
Moussa, je pense que la réponse à votre question est dans la nature même de ce qu'on a dit jusqu'à maintenant. Il y a un plan de paix, il y a des efforts diplomatiques qui sont faits pour essayer d'arriver à un cessez-le-feu immédiat, à tout ce que j'ai lu, à arrêter les souffrances de la population civile. Je pense que le secrétaire général a bien dit dans son message, et on l'a répété, on l'a entendu aussi par les autres collègues, qu'il faut se concentrer maintenant sur ça, il faut arrêter, il faut que les armes arrêtent, il faut que les cessez-le-feu se mettent en place maintenant. Il y a des discussions, on va suivre, nous on est en contact avec les médiateurs, avec les parties qui se réunissent et qui discutent, et on veut vraiment que cette partie, que cette mise en place de tout ce qu'on a dit jusqu'à maintenant se fasse, et se fasse dans les temps les plus brefs possibles pour vraiment arrêter la souffrance, surtout des civils. Il y aura sûrement d'autres aspects qu'il faudra discuter, ça viendra, mais là maintenant essayons de faire la chose qui est la plus importante, qui est mettre en place un cessez-le-feu, la libération des otages et l'entrée de l'aide humanitaire à Gaza en quantité pour que ces souffrances de la population de Gaza s'arrêtent, ou soit en tout cas alléviées. Et puis Jamie, sorry.
I just wanted to follow up on Nick's question earlier and others that have been made about this. For Christian, you mentioned the 400 malnutrition deaths. Can you somehow give us a chronicling, an evolution or a date by date counting of that, just to be able to help us get a trend line as to when those were actually happening? Have they eased up, for example, in the last few months, or was there, if I remember correctly, the peak period was sort of in the spring or early summer? Can you just give us a little bit more insight into what we can maybe read from the trend line of those malnutrition deaths, please?
Jamie, sorry, I missed when you said to whom the question. Yeah, he's still there, but it's I don't know why I can't see on the screen. It seems like it's frozen. Don't know if we can hear you. Christian, okay, you're there, up. Yeah, you're up. You're muted.
Now we can go.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I don't have a complete timeline, but remember that when there was a ceasefire in early spring, and the UN was able to bring in lots of medicines, food and supplies, and the partners, it had all eased up. And then came the complete blockade, and that's when the deaths really started. And well, let's start a different way. First, the malnutrition kicked in, the extreme undersupplying of food and any nutrition. And then slowly also the deaths, dying from hunger. Don't forget, malnutrition is a difficult thing, because you may die of an infection, you may die of a disease, but that is only because your body is so weakened that it can't fight anything anymore. And now, since we have supplies going into Gaza again, this has softened a bit, but it's not over, because as we all know, there was not a single day where enough humanitarian supplies came in to match the levels needed. the demands are much higher now than they used to be once upon a time, but there was not a single day where the famous 600 trucks were able to come in. So it's softened, but softened is really a cruel word here, because one death alone is already one death too many.
Just to add on figures on malnutrition, we know that over 10,000 children have been diagnosed with acute malnutrition in the past 2 months alone. And that we know that if disconnected from their treatment, there's a high risk for some of the 2,400 children currently being treated for severe acute malnutrition in the area and in the north in Gaza City that could starve to death. So this is the latest figure we have, and you can imagine with the displacement taking place and the ongoing bombardments and airstrikes in the area, that risk is only increasing.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you very much. Moussa, je voulais rajouter quelque chose à la réponse que je vous ai donnée tout à l'heure. Je ne sais pas si j'ai lu trop vite, mais là où vous faites la référence, et là j'ai traduit de l'anglais, je m'excuse si ce n'est pas très fluide, là où le secrétaire général parle effectivement de la proposition du président des États-Unis et il en parle comme une opportunité à prendre. Pour ramener à la fin de ce conflit tragique, il dit aussi « a permanent ceasefire and a credible political process ». Et je pense que j'ai lu ça. « A permanent ceasefire and a credible political process are essential to prevent further bloodshed and pave the way for peace. International law must be respected ». Donc, il y a aussi cette phrase qui, je pense, est importante pour vous répondre. On a un collègue qui est connecté pour UNHCR et qui doit partir à 11h30. Donc, j'aimerais bien donner la parole maintenant à Nina, et après aller à UNHCR. Nina, yeah. You have a question on Gaza, I guess.
Yes, on Gaza. Thanks for taking my question. It was for Christian. I just wanted to check on the... So on the 400 children, so WHO has verified these deaths, and as you mentioned, it's quite difficult when it comes to malnutrition deaths. How do you go about doing that? Thank you.
You're muted. Go ahead.
No, we got. I don't have details on how this verification goes about, Nina.
Nina?
Sorry, yeah, but you can confirm that WHO has verified those 400 deaths?
Correct. That's what we heard from Rick Pipokon last Friday.
That's right.
Even, that these are verified. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much. So I'd like to thank everyone who has been briefing us this morning. Thanks to Ricardo and to Jens and to Christian. And I'd like now to go to our colleagues of UNHCR. Eugene, yes, please. And I see we have online Xavier Krieg, who is the UNHCR representative in Mozambique, who's calling in from Pemba. You want to start, Eugene? Or we go straight to Xavier? Okay. Xavier, you have the floor. Thank you.
Bon dia, good morning, and thanks for giving me the floor. Yes, I'm calling from Pemba, where I've been over the last 2 weeks due to the emergency situation we're facing. I think OCHA last week already had the opportunity to explain the deteriorating context and its human impact in northern Mozambique. What we have witnessed this week alone is 22,000 newly displaced population. In only a week, the level of security incident affecting civilians, already 571 security incidents captured this year alone. It's higher than any of the past years in terms of intensity of the conflict. And of course, what we have witnessed over the last 2 weeks is extraordinary human suffering. Civilians are not anymore collateral victims of this conflict. Now they are directly targeted. Children are, of course, among those most affected, with lots of testimonies of forced recruitment, abduction, family separation, while they flee. Women are particularly exposed. They have been exposed during the attacks, they were exposed during displacement, while in particular, while they collect food or water. I've been particularly shocked by the situation of people with disabilities and elderly. Many have, of course, struggled to flee, but maybe have been left behind. And of course, the level of psychological distress, fear is extremely moving and concerning. UNHCR and many partners from other UN agencies, NGOs, civil society have developed a very strong operational response to address multiple protection issues linked to child protection, GBV, documentation, mental health, land dispute, and others. This in multiple locations simultaneously. I think it's an important point to flag. 15 districts of the Cabo Delgado province have been affected by violence this month. And in this context, I'm so excited that resources are critically lacking for all of us. You know, we have reached a level of violence and forced displacement, which is comparable to the peak of the crisis in 2020-21, when most humanitarian actors declared an emergency at that time and massively scaled up this operation. This time we are back with the same level of needs, except that we are all suffering significant shortfall in the funding. I would even like to give you these figures that 22 humanitarian actors had to close the shop in Cabo Delgado and leave the province in 25. So the response is really difficult. We are really struggling and we are in an invisible crisis now. I hope you guys in Geneva can help us to cover these human stories. I would like to finish by the human dimension after 2 weeks speaking to people every day in the field. And we really see a turning point here. Populations, civilians, displaced people are not only anymore traumatized, they're not only anymore afraid, but in addition, they're losing faith. We have heard again and again, we will never be displaced again. We are not getting support. Now we stay where we are. Same thing when it comes to solution. People are saying, we won't return. The experience has been too difficult. Most of the people I've seen had already been displaced twice or three times. According to official figures, 89% of the newly displaced already at the second displacement and third displacement. So thank you very much for your attention, and I hope to cover this story. I really need your support here. Thanks. Back to you.
Thank you very much, Xavier. You want to add something? Good question. I'll open the floor to questions in the room. Let me see if there are any hands up. I don't see any, or on the platform. No, there are no questions for you, but I'd like to thank you very, very much, because it's important that we continue putting the spotlight on this crisis. Thank you for being with us, and good luck with your important work. Thank you very much, Eugene. Thomas. I'll call now Thomas Fitzsimmons on the floor. Thomas, you have an announcement on the next IPU assembly. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks very much, Alessandra. A quick announcement from the Interparliamentary Union. Geneva will be once again the capital of global parliamentary diplomacy and dialogue from the 19th to the 23rd of October for the 151st IPU Assembly, which will take place at the International Conference Center, Rue de Varambe, just down the road. We're expecting some 120 countries to be represented, hundreds of parliamentarians and experts to address the theme upholding humanitarian norms and supporting humanitarian action in times of crisis. So very timely theme, I'm sure you agree, based on what we've heard this morning. And how can parliaments and parliamentarians, how can they support humanitarian action? Peace and security will also be very much at the forefront of discussions between the parliamentarians, especially through the IPU's dedicated mediation bodies, including the IPU Task Force for the Peaceful Resolution of the War in Ukraine and the IPU Committee on Middle East Questions, which also includes representatives from Israel and from Palestine. The IPU will also grow with the accession of the Brunei Parliament, who will be welcomed as our 182nd member parliament, And finally, we will also be announcing the winner of the 2025 Kramer Passy Prize, named after the IPU founders, the, if you like, the MP of the Year award. And this year we'll be honoring a parliamentarian who has shown exceptional leadership when it comes to gender equality, which is the theme, the IPU theme of the year. The five-day assembly is open to all of you. It's open to UN-accredited media. You're welcome to attend. And this morning, you should have received the media advisory, as well as the list of participants. If there are any politicians, any parliamentarians that you would like to interview, please don't hesitate to go through me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Thomas. Questions to IPU? Don't. But that's the other one you have. But do you have any question for Thomas? Yeah. Okay, go ahead then.
Thomas, thank you. What can IPU do to help countries like France that have a lot of discord within their parliament to iron out their differences? Because as you've seen, that country is having some difficulty in forming a new government because of discord within the parliament. Does IPU serve a role in that in any way?
Thank you, Jamie. Well, I mean, France is a very active member of the IPU, as one of the founding members of the Interparliamentary Union. We would not intervene in any national situation. But of course, I mean, our overall message is that parliaments need to be, they need to be strong, they need to be representative, and that includes having, as women parliamentarians, having young parliamentarians, representing different generations, different communities. So the more representative, the more inclusive a parliament, the stronger the democracy, and the better it can deliver for the people. So, I mean, we would offer generic support, capacity building, facilitating meetings between parliamentarians around the world who can share good practice. So that's where the IPU would intervene in that particular situation.
Just for the record, does anyone from the French Parliament is actually coming? And do you have anyone from the current Parliament? I mean, it might change in a couple of days.
So for the moment, from the list of participants that I sent, you'll have noticed that there is no representative from France for the moment. But usually, I mean, France, as I say, they're a very active member. They do attend. They're members of many of these committees. We have the senators, often the French senators who come, who are not necessarily affected by any future dissolution.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Thomas, and good luck with the assembly. Jamie.
We received late last night, early this morning here in Geneva about the UN staff in Yemen. Could you give us an update on that? And I have a few follow-up questions. Maybe you have just some preliminary lines that you can share with us, and then I have a follow-up.
Received the Secretary General spokesperson sent out a statement attributable to him yesterday. In fact, it was during the night, it's dated 6 October, on additional UN personnel arbitrarily detained by Houthi de facto authorities in Yemen. And I understand, Jimmy, you wanted to understand better the issue of the figures. So what happened most recently is that the de facto authority, Houthi de facto authorities, detained 9 additional UN personnel, bringing the total number of arbitrarily detained UN staff to 53 since 2021. So this is a cumulative number, and it's the update from the latest update that was given in September, I think it was the 15th of September, by Tom Fletcher, who spoke about 44 personnel detained. So basically, this is the update since that time, the briefing to the Security Council. This, unfortunately, is an ongoing situation. The operations of the Houthi are going on, and the numbers change, unfortunately, all the time. What we can see is that, I mean, what we can say is that in the areas controlled by the Houthi de facto authorities, all our UN operations are impacted, all of them. So all the agencies who are there are impacted. And I know you were asking about the breakdown of the various agencies. We don't communicate on that, but what I can tell you is that those who have a larger footprint, like, I don't know if Ricardo is still here, like UNICEF, obviously are more impacted, but these operations concern all the UN agencies who have a presence in those regions. And also, maybe I can add that the World Food Programme and UNICEF offices are still under the control of the Houthi de facto authority, are still occupied. So the situation is ongoing, and it's really, really difficult to tell you. You know, it's unfortunately changing all the time, and not for the better.
What are the scale of the UN operations currently? I mean, in these areas, how many UN staff are still there? And what is the impact of this crackdown? And I still have other questions, but I mean, I had sent you some questions earlier about, you know, how many of these are internationals? How many are Yemenis? You know, I mean, in an overall scheme of things, you know, if I remember correctly, at the beginning of September, there were roughly 21 staff, I think, or something like that, 23 maybe, since 2021, and now we're already up to 53. I mean, what is the UN doing to try to prevent this from happening again? It's not getting any better. It's getting worse. So, I mean, are you taking steps to ensure, is there anything that can be done to prevent this from happening? And sorry, if I could just follow up. I mean, what are you doing there was a release, a negotiation for a release of one staffer, I believe, from UNICEF over the summer, in the course of September, if I'm not mistaken. You know, how are these, you know, is there a quid pro quo here? I mean, are there ransoms being offered? Is there, how do you, is there an enticement for the Houthis to be taking more of these hostages through whatever the United Nations is doing in the back channels to try to win their release?
Yeah, okay, so as you know, I'm not the spokesperson for the office of the Yemen, but I have a few feedback here. First of all, let me say that we are extremely concerned, and the Secretary General is extremely concerned about the safety and security of the UN staff in Yemen. That is obvious. We are continuing, and we will continue to work tirelessly, as the spokesperson says, and through all available channels to secure the safe and immediate release of all arbitrarily detained personnel, the return of UN agency offices and other assets, and of course, of preventing that this happens again. On the scale of the operation, what I can say is that since last year's detentions, the UN has restricted its operation in Houthi-controlled areas to life-saving assistance only. Following the January 2025 detentions in Sada Governorate, the Secretary General also took the decision to suspend all operations in that area. The majority of our staffers in Yemen are Yemenis, and all of our detained staff are Yemenis. This is their home. Their job is to support their fellow citizens, save lives, provide life-saving assistance, and they should never be penalized for that or live in fear for future action by these de facto authorities. So this is more or less what I can tell you. We are continuing to work relentlessly, really using all available channels inside and outside Yemen to secure the release of our personnel and to prevent further action. If you have more specific questions, I have spoken with our colleague who is the person responsible for communication for our Yemeni operations, and she says that she's happy that you contact her. I'll give you the contact details after the briefing. Are there any other questions for me? Okay, so let me just announce you a couple of points. We all know that the Human Rights Council will close its 60th session tomorrow, They are voting today, yesterday, and today, and tomorrow. Still voting going on. Two press conferences to remind you. One tomorrow at 9 a.m. is by UNECE about the ministerial meeting on housing affordability and sustainability. Tatiana Molsian, the UN Undersecretary General and Executive Secretary of UNECE, will be there together with the State Secretary of Switzerland for the Federal Office for Housing, the Secretary of State, Ministry of Physical Planning, Construction and State Assets of Croatia, and the Mayor of the Glasgow City Council in the UK and Chair of the UN Forum of Mayors. On the 13th, so next week, at 2:30, UNCTAD will present you the upcoming conference, UNCTAD 16. As you know, the conference is organized in Geneva. The title of the conference is Shaping the Future, Driving Economic Transformation for Equitable, Inclusive and Sustainable Development, 2023rd of October, here at the Palais des Nations. The speaker at that press conference will be the Secretary General of UNCTAD, Rebecca Greenspan. I think that's all I have. Yes. Any other question? No? Thank you very much. I'll see you on Friday. Thank you.